So I'm going to talk for a few minutes today. I want to talk about working with koans, but I see it as growing out of the stuff we've been doing the last few times I've talked on Zen and pragmatism. So I'll be appealing a couple times to Wallace Stevens, who's an American modernist poet who's a great inheritor of pragmatism, and maybe make a bridge in a couple ways. Stevens talks about what he jokingly calls the lunatic of one idea, and says his extreme of logic would be illogical. So one of the things we've been talking about a lot the last few days, the last few weeks, is holding our models really lightly, keeping them multiple, and also being available to the moment where those models seem to fall away, at least for a moment, as we move in away from I had a scary childhood to I had a childhood to simply there was a childhood, and the sense memories that flow through really without any narrative, and in some sense coming face to face with something that's before the stories. Stevens also talks about the necessity to believe in a fiction which we know to be a fiction, which is a way of talking about the inevitable return of stories, and one hopes the ability to not be taken in a kind of chokehold by any one story, to be able to be a little more light about one's relation to the models one constructs. Joan reminds us that in Chinese, and I don't know the etymology or the characters at all, so I'm just relying on her there, that in the Chinese, the notion of relinquishing, so if we think about relinquishing our stories, it has less of a sense of a sort of a purgatorial, difficult exercise, and there's more of an emphasis apparently in the characters on once you relinquish something, your hands are free, and you're therefore free to pick up something else. So maybe in practice, as our relation to our habitual stories gets a little bit lighter, a little bit more porous, that's a little bit like putting something down sometimes, and so we're free to pick something else up. And what I want to suggest is that in Koan Zen, one of the crucial things we pick up is the koans, and we pick them up as kind of alternative models, alternative stories. And we don't do that in the hope that they will replace our other stories. You know, now I'm living in koans, so I'm not worried about my anxieties, or I'm not telling myself these other stories all the time. It's simply another series of stories to supplement the habitual stories that we usually tell ourselves. And we don't need to worry that the habitual stories won't come back to plague us, because at some moments and in some ways, they certainly will. But I want to think about koans as occupying this place as kind of stories, models that we can pick up and try on for a while. And I want to ask a little bit about why we might do that, but also how we might do it. So I have a couple of quotations from Stevens that are a little dry, and then we'll get to talking about koans. He was a really wonderful poet, but he was a little odd, and he was really interested in endowing a chair at Princeton, which wouldn't be poetry, but would sort of be the theory of poetry. So he was always sort of doing the theory of poetry. But this is just about a page that will set something up that's useful, I hope. It's an essay, not promisingly called Three Academic Pieces, that he wrote in 1947. But he talks about a notion of resemblance there. So suppose we examine one of the significant components of the structure of reality, that is to say, the resemblance between things. First then, as to the resemblance between things in nature, it should be observed that resemblance constitutes a relation between them, since in some case all things resemble each other. Take, for example, a beach extending as far as the eye can reach, bordered on the one hand by trees and on the other by the sea. The sky is cloudless and the sun is red. In what sense do the objects in this scene resemble each other? There is enough green in the sea to relate it to the palms. There is enough of the sky reflected in the water to create a resemblance in some sense between them. And then he goes on a little bit later to talk about metaphor in poetry or another language as having a certain relationship pretty clearly to resemblance. You know, X is like Y. So he says, the study of the activity of resemblance is an approach to the understanding of poetry. Poetry is a satisfying of the desire for resemblance. As the mere satisfying of a desire, it is pleasurable. But poetry, if it did nothing but satisfy a desire, would not raise above the level of many lesser things. Its singularity is that in the act of satisfying the desire for resemblance, it touches the sense of reality, it enhances the sense of reality, heightens it, intensifies it. So in that moment, we have an intenser relation to the real. If resemblance is described as a partial similarity between two dissimilar things, it complements and reinforces that which the two dissimilar things have in common. It makes it brilliant. And so the claim there is that in metaphor, in poetry, when one thing is named as another thing, not that we're saying that the two are identical, but that there's an aspect of A which is like an aspect of B, and in saying A is B, I heighten that resemblance and I make it brilliant. If you like set theory, which I like to appeal to in teaching poetry, what we're talking about there is the area of intersection. So if there's set A and set B, what is there about set A that set B also possesses? And when you say A is B, at least initially your attention is drawn to that resemblance and it's heightened and it's made brilliant. And again, that's not to say that when you say A is like B, you found the essence of A, or that A can only be named as B. It's a story that you can pick up for a moment, okay? So my hunch is that not all koans, but most koans really work like that. They say, what is A? A is B. And they offer that for your consideration to heighten it and make it brilliant. So for example, in Bellenhausen's Three Turning Words, the first of those is, what is Zen? And the answer in Jones' translation is, a silver bowl filled with snow. So what is Zen practice? A silver bowl filled with snow. It's not to say that's the only thing Zen practice is, but it's to say, take that up, consider it, whatever the overlap is between what Zen practice is like, or the truth of Zen is like, and snow in a silver bowl is like, sitting with that will heighten it and make it brilliant. Here's another one, and it's a little disconcerting because it's got two parts to it. I want to focus just on the second, but I guess you really need the two, at least initially, to think about them as resemblance. So the question is, this is also from Bellinghausen's Three Turning Words, what is the blown hair sword? And what that means is apparently the blown hair sword was a sword that was so sharp that if a single hair were blown by the breeze against it, it would cut the hair. So it's this incredibly sharp sword. And then the answer is really odd, but anyway, what is the blown hair sword? Each branch of coral holds up the light of the moon. Okay, and I guess it's only in the relation between those two that at least initially it looks like a metaphor or an analogy, though I'm going to do something else with it in a moment. But I want you to hold on to especially each branch of coral holds up the light of the moon. And so the question I want to ask is, if there is this aspect of resemblance of heightening something and making it brilliant, and that's part of what koans do, how do we work with koans and what do they have to offer us? So the first thing I want to say as a literature teacher who works with metaphor a lot, and the way we don't work on it is to figure out intellectually the one thing it means, and then we can quickly sort of get rid of the metaphor. So a version of that would be, you know, what is Zen? A silver bowl filled with snow. You say, oh, snow is cold. Coldness must stand for having no emotion. And so what the koan quote unquote means is that we can't be emotional if we're going to study Zen, you know, and okay, I'm done, on to the next koan. So clearly, I mean, that's not at all the invitation the koans hold out to us. So again, as somebody who spends a lot of time with metaphor, the way would be, again, not exactly, you know, to kind of cognize it, intellectualize it, and figure out what it means, but just to dwell in it for a while. And I think the first step typically, I'm not sure this is always true, but in some way is to forget even about the resemblance aspect and just sit with the image, okay? So if we're working on what is Zen, a silver bowl filled with snow, I think, you know, we're likely, if we're trying to think about koans as something that have answers that we want to crack open, we're likely at first to take it up as a puzzle and say, I'm going to figure out what's the aspect of Zen practice that's like snow in a silver bowl. Probably the better way to work is to forget the question even and just sit with snow in a silver bowl. So you let that thing in. You can't do it if you've never seen snow in your life or if you've never seen a silver bowl. But if you've seen them, you have some idea of what that would be like to have snow in a silver bowl, and you can let that really seep into you. You don't have to do anything with it for a long time. You might ask, you know, sort of what feelings it provokes in you, but you can just sit there really for a long time with snow in a silver bowl. So one of the things that does that's already, I think, a blessing in many ways is that there you are sitting with your sense memories of the world. You know, so there you are, there's the snow, there's the silver bowl. You don't have to make a point of it. You don't have to make an argument. You just sit with it. And you're also, I think, therefore sitting, at least to some extent, though it'll turn back into a story in some way, you're sitting with that level below story, just that level of sense memory. And one of the great gifts of the koans is that they offer you something to think about, you know, something just to sit with and be with. So, oh, today it's water, tomorrow it's snow, another time it's a rock. And I mean, it's a very elementary practice in some way, but just to be with the rock, just to be with the snow, just to be with the water is a blessing, and it's a really good thing to be doing. So I think what happens, at least in my experience, if you do that and you don't try to figure out what the bleep and answer is that at some point, the relationship between you and this sense memory of something that's outside you, that relationship begins to get a little blurry or a little fuzzy. And I think in some sense what happens is you begin to feel what it would be like to have that space of snow in a silver bowl inside you. It's as if your own sensorium has imagined it so intensely that it's not exactly like you're it, but you could feel like what it would be like to be that, or you can feel those qualities moving in you. You really let them in and let them permeate you until, to some extent, the feeling or the qualities of snow in a silver bowl are your qualities. And I think we do that as much as we can before we put a lot of names to it. You know, we just let that happen. It's maybe easier, let's say, if you take the one, each branch of coral holds up the light of the moon. And in the wonderful talk that Joan gave, where she talks about that koan, she says that at least some of us are lucky enough to have actually seen a coral sea, which is usually tropical. The water's really wonderfully warm. The coral beds go on and on almost endlessly. So that sense of the coral sea in moonlight with each branch of coral holding up that light is something you can sit with for a pretty long time. And at some point, I think, you may get the feeling that the quality of your own interior attention, of your own interior space, has been so deeply colored by what you're thinking about that you recognize those qualities in yourself. So there, and that's the point, in one way, in which metaphor or analogy returns. Oh yeah, snow in a silver bowl, not someplace else, right here. Oh, each branch of coral holds up the light of the moon, the coral sea at night. Oh, not somewhere else, right here in me. You know? So one of the things that may happen with that is that you may then begin to enumerate some of the qualities that are there. I don't think you necessarily have to do that. If you go in to talk to a teacher, you're kind of likely to do it. Oh, I felt so X, or I felt so Y. And I just want to say a quick thing about metaphor, and then something else a little different. So one of the things that theorists of metaphor, especially in poetry, are likely to talk about, that characteristically, if you say A is like B, there's one thing that sort of leaps out as the obvious basis for the comparison. And so a traditional one is, let's not even do that. Let's just do snow is a silver bowl. What's Zen? Snow in a silver bowl. You might initially think, oh, the coldness. So that's what's like Zen practice or something like that. If you sit with snow in a silver bowl, there are lots and lots of other qualities of that snow that might be less immediately apparent, but that will start to kind of bubble up in you as the other aspects of that resemblance, you know, so something incredibly still, something incredibly quiet, something that's evanescent inside something that's not. Another one that I remember for me that was really important as I sat with it is, if you have snow in a silver bowl on an altar, let's say, you got the snow someplace, and so the snow in that bowl is a little bit of the snow that just goes on for miles and miles and miles, and so that's part of the koan, that if you feel the snow inside you, it's also part of this vast expanse of still snow that covers everything and makes it in some sense identical. So all those aspects, you know, are likely to sort of come to the fore as you sit with the koan for a while. The other thing to say about that, I suppose, say it two different ways. The rhetorical critic Kenneth Burke says someplace, it's really beautiful, he says that in poetry there's in some way an invitation to make ourselves over in the image of the imagery. Let me say it again. It says there's an invitation to make ourselves over in the image of the imagery. And koans, I think, really work that way. They're an invitation to take up that aspect of the world and of yourself and to make yourself over in that image. So for a while, be like snow in a silver bowl. Be like the coral sea at night. You know? And so what would it be like to let those qualities sort of come to the fore and to enhance them and let them exfoliate, let them ripen? So another thing about this practice, I think, is that one of the things that John Terence says that I really like is he says, whatever koan you're working with, everything is that. So he says, if you're working on Bring Me Your Original Face before your parents were born, you walk around, you drive your car, everything you meet is original face. If you're working on the coral sea, everything you meet is the coral sea. And so that's another, or if you're working on snow in a silver bowl, everything is snow in a silver bowl. And again, what we're looking at is resemblance heightened and made brilliant. You know, we're not saying it's the only thing that's true. So what's it like to walk around in the desert and think, ah, the coral sea, you know, each branch of coral holds up the light of the moon. What's it like to walk around when you're walking your dog and ask, you know, how is everything I see original face? So you look at the tree, how is the tree original face? And I think it works both ways. I mean, if you're making some progress with the koan and you have a feel for what original face is like, you say, oh, how beautiful, the tree is original face. You know, if you're stuck, it might be, I have no idea what my original face is, but holy shit, I just saw the tree's original face. You know, so there's that. Two things. So one thing about that is that if you spend a lot of time sitting with the koan, then in some sense, the kind of states that it brings up in you, the koan can be a mnemonic for. So if you've sat with the koan long enough, like original face, like the coral sea, you can call up that aspect of things really pretty much whenever you want. And so there's an aspect of the world that's very rich and powerful and beautiful that koan work will allow you to see as a crucial aspect of reality. The one other thing I want to just go back and pick up that I forgot when I was quoting the Kenneth Burke in terms of making yourself over in the image of the imagery. There's that really startling line from Hawkwind's commentary. It's actually from the fire-ending Kalpa Koan, where he says about the student that he says he doesn't realize that he's being offered a method of changing his very bones. And so the idea would be that taking up this kind of work can really change what qualities you're able to call up, what qualities of yourself you know about, what qualities of the world you can see in a way that can be quite radical and really important. In general, what I'd say is that if you walk around with these stories from time to time or often, they'll tend to soften you, they'll tend to soften the borders between the you and the not you, and then we'll begin to open things up in a way that can really continue to flower. So the only other thing I want to do is just read a couple few koans if we have time. We almost don't. All right, I won't. I'll just read you one that we remember. Do you remember the one, so how does the Bodhisattva Guanyin use all those eyes and hands? Oh, it's like someone reaching behind her in the dark for a pillow, and the student says, I understand. What do you understand? It's like eyes and hands all over the body, and the teacher says, oh, that's about 80% of it. Well, what about you, teacher? What's the other 20%? It's like eyes and hands all through the body. So what's it like to sit with that, and what's it like to walk around where everything you see is, for now, eyes and hands all through the body? So I'm sorry that went on a little longer.
Say it one more time. Yeah. I'm not hearing.
Yeah, it's why does the Bodhisattva Guanyin have all those eyes and hands? Because in the statue, she's depicted that way. So the teacher says, it's like someone reaching behind her for a pillow in the night, you know, to adjust the pillow.
The student says that.
No, the teacher says that.
Okay.
Yeah, and then the student says, oh, I understand.
Oh, right.
And the teacher says, what do you understand by that? And the student says, eyes and hands all over the body. And the teacher says, oh, that's about 80% of it. Oh, what's the other 20%? Eyes and hands all through the body. Okay. And then in the commentary for that, Yuan Wu says, oh, that has the same meaning as this other koan where somebody says, oh, and I won't give you the background, but oh, it's like a donkey looking at a well. And the teacher says, that's 80%. What's the other 20%? It's like the well looks at the donkey. Okay. But so, comments, questions? We're almost out of time. I apologize for that.
But we have a few minutes.
Yeah.
I just like, you know, sort of hearing your, just what you just brought, you know, about just a ways to be with koans. I just think that's a really good thing for us all to be always talking about, you know, and what does it mean other than on koan times. And that idea that the koan is, you know, a replacement story for some of the other stories that we normally, like it's a, I guess I would see it as a sort of a fresh way to see things rather than the same way that I'm, the same stories that I'm carrying around.
And so, I mean, you know, maybe if your stories are difficult that week or something, it's pretty interesting to walk around with the coral sea for a while, and it really does give a kind of vast perspective to things, so that when you come back to the other stories, which you undoubtedly will, you really have a different relation to them.
Yeah, and even if the stories that I'm carrying around are not difficult, they're the same ones I'm used to.
That's great.
You know, so it helps me just have a different way of being, seeing, perceiving.
I mean, the koans really will invite you, I mean, you know this, but will invite you into the space of the vastness. And I think it really is in terms of that, oh, just be with it, you know, feel it in you, or see it out there.
I like the, just the image that you started out with of putting down the story that you carry around, and then you have your hands free, pick up something else.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
That's very nice.
Yeah, that's from Joan. I like that, the relinquishing. There.
The well looking at the donkey hit me as being able to see things from the other side, from another place.
That's right. And I think the invitation is really, really walk around seeing the well look at the donkey.
I do that a lot. Yeah. This sounds odd, but like I'm sculpting a garden and everything, and I look at it, and then I go and I look at it from another place, and I different perspectives. So I kind of do that in a certain way, in a physical way, but it's also an emotional, mental way.
One thing I forgot to say is when you talk about the physical, it reminds me, and also you have such a strong tie to the kinetic stuff, that I think often the similarity, at least for me, I mean, it's visual because you're seeing it with your eye, but a lot of it is kinetic or tactile. So for example, if I'm walking around seeing the coral sea in the landscape, it's not like, oh, the cactus looks like a thing of coral, but a lot of the movements of things are like that. And then, and this particular thing is real important to me, there's this thing where, and some of the koans talk about this, where air begins to have a kind of water-like quality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if you see this, the landscape as the coral sea, then it's all in liquid in some way. And there's so many, again, I don't want to tell you what the area of intersection is, but that area of intersection where, oh, the air is like water, you know, that's so rich, and there's so much stuff that, and again, it's not like, oh, air is really water, but there's an aspect of things moving in air that's a little bit like things moving in water. And if you see that, there's something, I don't even want to say beautiful, but your relation to the things that are around you shifts, as you get that feel for, oh, it's as if they're in, it's as if, you know, they're in water and they're moving with the flow of the mm-hmm. of the water. It really changes things.
Well, I listen to sounds in the garden, the birds and everything, but I've created this little Zen garden in the very back under a tree. I have this one really nice tree, and I said, I really want to sit under the tree, as I was working back there. And I finally kind of have it almost together, and I was just sitting there meditating yesterday. And it was like I could hear all the different sounds, but I became enveloped in it, and I was part of it rather than from the house hearing it. Mm-hmm. It was like, sir, it was like really, yeah. really yeah, wonderful. But I it's almost like what you're
yeah,
saying.
Yeah, I think it's exactly like what
I
I'm
mean,
saying.
I just sat there and yeah. it became part yeah. of everything, yeah. the wind, the sounds, yeah. you know. Yeah. And there were so many yeah. sounds back there, because it's where there's other properties where it's just trees, and so yeah. all the animals were back there.
Yeah.
It was just really fabulous.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. I think the cones make you attentive in a way that's really similar to that.
Yeah, to that feeling. Yeah, but I mean, yeah. it was like, oh my God.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah. Thank you. That's great.
That's great.
Okay, thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
That's great. Yeah, thank you.